It is Thursday, and every week, Aaron Lee, Executive Director of Interval House, takes a look at one of the jury recommendations from the Culleton, Cusack, and Warmerdam inquest into ending intimate partner violence in Ontario. Aaron is with me now. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Bob.
It is good to have you back, and we're at number 58. Hard to believe that we've come this far.
What an amazing journey it's been, and I really hope that it's assisting people in the community. And I really appreciate the efforts of Lake 88 to continue to make sure that this information remains newsworthy and relevant, and out there for our listeners.
Well, we'll get right to it. Number 58 says the province must commission a comprehensive, independent, and evidence-based review of the mandatory charging framework employed in Ontario with a view to assessing its effect on IPV rates and recidivism, with particular attention to any unintended negative consequences. So I'll get you to explain this a little bit more, but is this basically talking about what would warrant a particular charge? Is it trying to determine which charge goes to which offense? And how does that work?
Mandatory charging is something that I would say the women's movement really, really pushed for many years ago. And mandatory charging has become quite complex because when officers attend the scene, mandatory charging would suggest that you have to assess for the dominant aggressor, you have to assess injuries, you have to explore the dynamics and what happened, and then you would apply a mandatory charge to the person who was the offender. What we see as particularly problematic is often when what we would see as the victims are charged as an offender. And so we have situations where a woman defended herself and she ends up charged in them according to mandatory charging. And so we've seen an increase over the years. It's been kind of up and down where we'll see a domestic occur and both parties are charged based on mandatory charging. And so a woman used a fork, yes, to defend herself as she was being strangled, and used a fork and forked the abuser in the arm, and as a result of that, both parties have been charged. And so it really provides little to no resolve when the victim is then also the offender. We really need to look at mandatory charging not working in terms of escalation, of the perpetrator, intimidation tactics, and women recanting. And so, not just women, I'm sorry, but victims recanting. There are a number of dynamics. So, women recanting, dual or counter charging, the whole process of mandatory charging is to serve victims of crimes so they're not responsible for laying a charge. So back in the day, it used to be, hey, Bob, do you want the person charged? And that was kind of in your foray of decision making, and that seemed onerous on the victims. So we fought for this change around mandatory charging. And then mandatory charging came into play, and then we've seen kind of the dynamics that happen in mandatory charging, where victims recant, victims are unsure, they're at more risk, so they don't want to follow through. Police are trying to do their jobs. Dominant aggressor is sometimes not as easy as one might think to determine. You've got both sides to a story and a highly emotional and crisis situation. So we really do feel like in this particular recommendation is saying, let's do a review of that. Let's look at the evidence around how it's been applied, how it's being used, how is it working or not working in terms of reducing the rates of recidivism and doing what the intention was, right? Which was to take that onus away from a victim and have the system work better in support of making creating safer communities. Not always working. We need to have a review of that to determine Is it really reducing IBV rates? And sometimes it increases the volatility and the risk factors. So there's release conditions. There's been mandatory charging. There's release conditions. And now there's an additional level of risk and dynamic that is happening on the outside, despite the fact that the system was trying to stop those dynamics from happening.
Really interesting. I know very little to none about this. And are some of the victims recanting because they don't want to be charged?
I would say that often victims recant because of threat and intimidation and fear. Not fear about being charged, not fear about what could happen to them from the legal perspective, but fear of survivorship, right? So, sometimes women will recant because the abusers have played the right cards and are on the outside trying to manipulate. And so women are like, I'm going to minimize that, right? It wasn't that bad. That's the father of my children. That's my partner. My partner's agreed to get help. I want to rectify this situation. I don't want to use my statement. I don't want to testify in court. I don't want to do those things. I want it to go away. And so people recant. And fear and intimidation are huge factors. And the issue of survivorship, really, for many, is about day to day. And so from one day to the next, it's really difficult. So one day I can do the statement and I feel I have the courage and support to do so. The next day I'm feeling like I should never have done that because now, there's been an indication or I've heard that, things are just going to get worse for me and I'm going to end up, in more trouble with my abuser and I'm more scared. So I just don't want to engage.
Okay, Aaron, thank you so much for this. As always, very important information, and your perspective is very much appreciated.
Thank you so much.
I'm Bob Perot for Lake 88 and LanarkLeadsToday.ca.